seated, please.
The court is now ready to hear argument in 070040 in Re Global Santa Fe Corporation.
May it please the court, Mr. Dove will present argument for the relator. For rebuttal. May it please the court. The Texas legislature created a set of procedures to deal with what it called a crisis in asbestos and silica litigation, a problem that it acknowledged had originated in Texas and was still at its worst in Texas. This case asks whether that act of crisis management can be thwarted any time any claimant in a case files any claim under federal maritime law. The lower courts held that it was preempted in its entirety when such a claim was brought. We believe that was overly broad and suffers from the mistake of believing that Chapter 90 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code is just one thing. In fact, it serves several purposes. It takes the existing set of pretrial MDL courts created under this court's rules promulgated in 2003 and places all asbestos and silica cases into those courts for the benefits that they provide.
But when you're talking about preemption, if the effect of that is to require a minimum level of injury before the case can proceed, if that's true, then what are we doing here?
This court has before it two different views as to what to do with that problem. We have briefed the case by showing that if that is preempted by the Jones Act and or other federal maritime laws, the rest of Chapter 90 still must be enforced. It still has value. It still stands on its own and serves a purpose. This court now also has before it the opinion of the Ohio Supreme Court, which would go further and say that it does not offend the Jones Act. Either view can be expressed here. Either view leads to the result that we advocate.
So answer whether it offends the Jones Act. That's what I want to know.
Your question goes to an issue that has deviled the courts dealing with asbestos and silica litigation. There is a class of claimants who can possibly be diagnosed as having the disease asbestosis or silicosis because they have the characteristic scarring in their lungs. But they feel fine. They have no symptoms. They have no impairments. They have no disability. There has been a movement over time as to how one addresses these problems. For instance, the Restatement Second of Torts says that a physical injury is any impact upon the body, even if it does not cause an impairment. The Restatement Third of Torts says that you must have a physical impairment. The cases across the states have also struggled with this. Pennsylvania has come down firmly in the impairment court. It is unclear where other states are. The FILA decisions have not been models of clarity.
Sounds substantive to me. I mean, level of impairment sounds like a substantive issue the courts are dealing with. And I understand your argument to be that this is merely procedural.
The Ohio Supreme Court's view is that we require all plaintiffs to simply say they have an injury. It's not substantive to say you must have an injury. We require everybody to plead an injury as a matter of procedure. And it's not substantive, and it doesn't change the law, if you will.
But whether there is an injury is a matter of substantive law, based on what I understood you were just saying. I mean, the restatement goes this way. Courts are struggling with it. Why isn't pleading an injury is one thing, but what constitutes an injury, why isn't that substantive?
In the Ohio Supreme Court's view, it's not substantive in the sense of federal preemption law because it does not change the federal rule. They conclude that the Jones Act requires an impairment. Because we require an impairment, there is no change. We're not impeding anything. I say that because that is the Ohio Supreme Court's view. As this court knows, we have briefed this as if it does preempt it. There are, we must confess, some cases historically that have said such claimants can recover certain modest kinds of costs. For instance, medical monitoring costs to determine whether you actually do have an impairment in the future. The point, though, is that even if this is substantive, even if this does preempt this particular portion of Texas's statute, the solution is not to find all of Chapter 90 preempted, as the Court of Appeals did. Apart from this one portion, Chapter 90 serves several other purposes. It requires the claimant to produce evidence of the diagnosis at the beginning of the case, as in a medical malpractice case. It sets out clinical standards for that medical diagnosis. For instance, it requires certain qualifications from the doctor. It requires that the differential diagnosis be performed in certain ways to ensure that it's reliable. It limits the certain kinds of opinions that doctors may rely on because they are unreliable.
What if it said the report has to have two experts who are board certified to bless the report?
I believe in that circumstance it would not be preempted because it's still a matter of evidence and proof. You
what
haven't changed the standard applied in the court for the cause of action.
What if it said clear and convincing proof?
I believe any change in the burden of proof would actually be preempted. Because we're not changing that, we're simply talking about evidentiary matters. We don't reach that point. It's been well established in the Jones Act and FELA cases that, for instance, Rule 702 still applies. And in fact, courts have rejected the argument that it somehow offends the Jones Act to require a reliable medical diagnosis that gets past the gatekeeper requirements. You still must do that. And as this court explained in BorgWarner versus Flores, you still have to prove, for instance, that you have an adequate dose of asbestos exposure to cause asbestosis. This isn't anyone creating a law that impedes anything. It's medical science. It's just the way it works. The Court of Appeals erroneously viewed these requirements as somehow having an effect on the causation requirement of the Jones Act. Though you'll note that in the opinion, the Court of Appeals seemed to be fishing around a bit for how to explain it. Well, it's not direct causation, maybe, but it's some sort of causation. The problem the court was having is one that this court explained in Morgan versus CompuGraphic. Causation is not one thing. It has multiple steps. To require that a claimant prove that he have a certain kind of disease, that is, that he have asbestosis as opposed to histoplasmosis, lupus, any of the other diseases that cause the same opacities, does not change the burden of proof. It doesn't change the causation requirement. It's just a matter of medical fact. You still have to prove that this somehow ties back to the negligence of the defendant. Chapter 90 has nothing to say about that, does not impact it in any way. It remains well within the bounds of the types of rules that remain procedural, matters of evidence, matters of expert testimony. Lopez has also fretted that this might somehow impact the featherweight causation requirement that has historically been applied in Jones Act cases. Once again, that ignores the fact that there is a two-step process. Chapter 90 does not impact that second part, the connection to the defendant. And furthermore, as we've briefed, it's not at all clear that the featherweight causation standard still applies after Norfolk and Western Railway versus Sorrell, which was decided in January 2007. The other part of the statute, and the one that is most directly applicable to this case, is the one that transfers the case from the court to the pretrial court, and then permits a remand back to the trial court when it's done. The Court of Appeals held that this was preempted because it somehow touched this report requirement. The problem with this analysis, however, is that the United States Supreme Court has said that that doesn't matter. In American Dredging versus Miller, it is said just as clearly as it possibly could. We admit, the court says, that it's awfully difficult to tell exactly what the boundaries of federal maritime preemption are. However, we do know this. The maritime law is supposed to be applied in any court in the world, and as a result, we don't expect uniformity of process. Based on that rule, it held that where the trial is held, which court hears the case, has no interest whatsoever to the federal maritime law. In this case, it could be put into the asbestos MDL pretrial court or the silica MDL pretrial court. It could be put into any court in the state. The legislature could create the John B. Lopez Honorary Court to hear his claim. It still would not offend the federal maritime law. so long as he gets what the Supreme Court called the rudimentary due process due him, he would get what he is entitled to.
If you're right that the NDL statute is not totally preempted by the Jones Act, and the case is sent up to the NDL court, would the NDL court have to treat that case differently because it's a Jones case than the other non-Jones cases?
The one difference that would be required is the standard applied to the report that would be produced. We've advocated the position that what this court should do is delete that requirement of an impairment from the report requirement, but leave intact the other aspects of it that prevent the kind of outcome that Judge Jack described in her opinion in the Celica MDL in federal court.
When that gets applied,
then, it's treated largely the same. The question would still be, you must produce this at the beginning of the case rather than later. You must follow these requirements to ensure that the differential diagnosis is done reasonably and reliably. There would be the one difference that report would not have to attest to an impairment. Otherwise, it gets applied exactly the same as any other case.
So what does this board-certified physicians who've done the physical exam report say?
As we've laid out in our brief, it attests that it's done by somebody board certified in the proper disciplines, that an examination has been done personally by the doctor, that the doctor has personally or with somebody who he directly supervises taken a detailed exposure and medical history with precise details regarding their smoking history and exactly how long and how much they've been exposed to various toxins and to cigarette smoke. All of that information is attached to the report. It cannot be left out. They must not rely on reports from doctors that have some sort of difficulty with admission in the state in which they were admitted. And they must include all of this information as part of their report. It seems almost modest.
It's really a report about the doctor, not about the plaintiff that you want.
I think that's a fair statement. It seems almost silly that we would have to say these things. As Judge Jack noted in her very lengthy opinion, you cannot render a reliable differential diagnosis without doing each and every one of these things. However, there are so many doctors. There was such a crisis of doctors not having these qualifications that the Texas legislature decided that we had to spell it out. That doesn't offend the Jones Act in any way. It stays well outside of the requirements that one must prove. Whether or not one believes that the definition of an injury under the Jones Act includes impairment or could also be broader and include somebody who merely has a diagnosis of the disease and a doctor willing to say that it's more likely than not that it will progress to some sort of impairment in the future.
But you'd be satisfied then with that report from the doctor, even if the doctor didn't think the fellow had silicosis. Because everything you listed is just the test that the doctor does and how qualified the doctor is. What would be the point of getting a report from somebody who doesn't think he has silicosis and letting it go forward anyway? That if Judge Jack's concern is what we're concerned about, that won't do anything about it.
I recognize your point, and that's an excellent point. Under Section 90006 and 90010B, the report would have to attest that there is an asbestos-related injury or a silica-related injury, that is a diagnosis. Even Mr. Lopez has admitted that he has to provide some evidence of a diagnosis of the disease for which he sues. The distinction being, you would not have to attest that that disease has reached the point of an impairment.
So before Chapter 90, Jones Act plaintiff could bring suit and not have to establish that prima facie case, I'll call it. And after Chapter 90, you say you must.
Justice Jefferson, I would say that slightly differently. Before Chapter 90, the Jones Act plaintiff would have to prove a diagnosis of a disease that was done in a reliable manner. After Chapter 90.
But the case could be tried without first having to produce this
I don't believe that is the case.
Okay.
At some point, you would have to provide medical evidence that you have asbestosis or silicosis or an asbestos-related injury, to be precise, rather than asbestosis.
You could do that during trial, or you, at some pretrial point, you're saying?
Through the discovery process. What Chapter 90 does that makes it slightly different is it requires the report to be produced early rather than at the last possible moment for designation of experts and declaration of their reports. It also imposes these additional requirements for that report, which are not spelled out in federal court, but nonetheless, in a federal court, Rule 702 would apply.
No further questions? Thank you very much. The court is ready to hear argument from the real party in interest.
May it please the court, Mr. Black will present argument for the real party in interest.
Good morning, may it please the court. I want to apologize. I'm a little bit under the weather. It's come on me in the last 24 hours or so, but I will try not to cough through this. I'd like to begin with a discussion generally of the Jones Act. It is, for all practical purposes, a workers' compensation system for merchant marines. This court in 1999 had the opportunity to analyze the Jones Act in the Steyer case, which is cited in our brief, calling it a comprehensive tort recovery regime and finding that states may not enact laws that work a material prejudice to the characteristic features of the Admiralty.
But there's no defined benefit, right?
Exactly.
I mean, you go to trial and you get a damage award, so it's pretty much unlike the workers' compensation.
It's unlike it in the sense that there's not a defined benefit, but it's like it in that it's all these merchant seamen have, in essence. They don't have a state workers' comp system. They can sue third parties that are involved in the injury that occurs on the vessel, but they're not governed by state tort law in that. It's the general maritime law, and they're entitled to recover 100% of their injuries just from their employer defendant, who then has to seek contribution from the other parties. It is a different system in the sense that under the Jones Act, they're entitled to go essentially joint and severally liable against their employer outside of the comp system.
The Jones Act itself is pretty short, as I recall.
Very short.
And it doesn't address the whether impairment is required or not required.
It does not. And the Jones Act incorporates all of the case law under the FELA. And as recently as 2003 in the Ayers case at the United States Supreme Court, which is actually not cited in anybody's brief, Norfolk and Western versus Ayers, 538 U.S. 135, asbestosis without impairment is a compensable disease under the FELA and thus compensable under the Jones Act as well.
Okay, so what would be wrong? I mean, as opposing counsel has defined it, what would be wrong with the MDL panel if the MDL panel applied the Jones Act causation standard and set the case accordingly, said that if the expert report met that lower featherweight causation standard, it could then be assigned to trial. If it were parsed that way, why wouldn't then the assignment to trial just be procedural in nature?
Well, I think that's a very good question, Justice O'Neill, and I think that's what the 14th Court of Appeals recognized in this case, is at some point preemption happens, that the substantive impairment criteria in 90.004 are preempted by the Jones Act. So it either happens before the case is transferred to the MDL, or it happens the instant he gets there, or it happens a little further down the road, or it happens before remand for trial.
And but you don't really care which, as long as the appropriate causation standard applies.
Exactly. And that was our position at the very beginning. As a matter of fact, in oral argument before Judge Christopher, was the problem is not MDL transfer per se. The problem is what happens once the case gets there. The preemption has to happen at some point.
But you, and to be clear, you don't mind being in Judge Christopher's...
I love Judge Christopher all the time.
But this is being broadcast, so...
I think he knows.
But you're concerned about how far are the requirements of Chapter 90 going to be applied in Jones Act cases?
Exactly.
But for scheduling depositions and that kind of stuff, it would be better to be in the MDL court. Otherwise, you're going to run into all the scheduling problems and conflicts that gave rise to the MDL process in the first place.
Well, the MDL court is set up for product liability cases. All of the discovery, there are master discovery orders that have been entered in the MDL that all relate to product liability cases. They don't have anything to do with premises liability or employer cases, such as this one. The case management order that was adopted by Judge Christopher requires a Chapter 90 report before you can proceed with discovery, for example. So once we get to the MDL, the problem is that we would be constantly moving for relief from something that's in the MDL anyway, because it's really not set up for these cases. And I know it's not a dispositive issue, but during the negotiations for the case management order in the MDL, Jones Act and FELA cases were exempted, largely for this reason, that they don't really fit the mold of what we were doing in the MDL.
And so how would it work then? So you would say you don't want to go through the MDL constriction because there, many of them are preempted by the Jones Act. So what is your ideal situation?
Well, this gets to how the case was actually transferred to the MDL in the first place, which I think was what was highly important and relevant to the Court of Appeals, that there are two distinct mechanisms for transfer to an MDL. Rule 13.5, the related case, tag-along transfer, and the subsequent Rule 13.11 that this court adopted that is a Chapter 90 or failure to comply with Chapter 90 transfer. This particular case was transferred to the MDL for failing to file a Chapter 90 compliant report on or before a date certain as specified in Chapter 90. The amicus case, the Broussard case in Judge Davidson's court, was transferred under Rule 13.5. And respectfully to Judge Davidson, I think he got it wrong. He should have kept the case because, in our view, a related case is a related case is a related case. It doesn't matter if it's under the Jones Act or Texas tort law. It's an asbestos case, and the broad grant of MDL jurisdiction is such that he can grab all the asbestos cases, and they sit there. A brief was filed yesterday, amicus brief, by Union Carbide adopting that exact position of ours, that there's nothing in Judge Davidson's grant of authority or jurisdiction that should have compelled him to remand that particular case. It was a post-9103 filing. So our view is if Chapter 90 is preempted once he gets there, how is it not preempted on his way in? And that was what the Court of Appeals, rather than picking and choosing when preemption occurs, they just said it's all preempted. And you just stay out and go according to the rules, the regular Texas rules of civil procedure, and proceed to trial in the court in which the case was originally filed.
Where did the Ohio Supreme Court get it wrong?
How
or is it just distinguishable because their state law is different than our state law?
They got it wrong. They did not acknowledge the U.S. Supreme Court opinion in the Ayers case, which I cited earlier, that specifically says that you don't have to have an impairment in order to have a compensable disease under the FELA. And the Ohio substantive, you know, their version of Chapter 90 is just like ours. It requires an impairment. And I know a writ of certiorari is being prepared in that case, in the Bogle case, to the U.S. Supreme Court. And all due respect to Ohio, I think they just got that one wrong.
Do you have an objection to filing the report opposing counsel was talking about? I'm a board certified specialist. I haven't been licensed. I've talked to the guy for a long time and done all the tests, and he's got silicosis.
No, in that it's always been required. And I want to talk for a moment about the difference between Rule 702 and 90.004. Per Judge Jack, and I think this is an undisputed point, in order for a reliable and credible diagnosis of silicosis, one has to have adequate latency, adequate exposure to the toxin, radiographic changes consistent with silicosis, and the absence, the physician has to rule out essentially other more probable causes of the radiographic changes. Well, 90.004 essentially requires those things plus a B read or some specified level of an X-ray reading, size of nodules, etc., pulmonary function testing, class 2 impairment under the American Medical Association guides to the evaluation of permanent impairment, and this causation statement that the medical findings and impairment are not more probably the result of causes other than silica given the occupational exposure, smoking, and medical history. Well, if you take out the preempted portions and you just look at the rest of Chapter 90, the physician has to take an occupational history, a medical history, and an exposure history. Well, all three of those things are necessary to determine whether the exposure was adequate under Rule 702, or the adequate latency exists, or that there are other more probable causes of the X-ray changes. The Chapter 90 requirement that principal employments be detailed is part of the exposure history. The nature, duration, and frequency of exposure to dust, including silica, that can cause pulmonary impairment is all part of adequacy of exposure and ruling out other more probable causes of radiographic changes. There's simply a restatement of what is already subsumed within the Rule 702 requirements. So the non-preempted portions of Chapter 90 are already the law in Texas, and have been the law in Texas, in order for a plaintiff to have a Rule 702 compliant, reliable and credible diagnosis of silicosis. Now, Global Santa Fe talks about BorgWarner and a dose. Well, I think they're conflating admissibility and legal sufficiency of causation evidence. And, you know, the Rule 702 in federal court, Daubert applies, and state court, Robinson applies, to the extent Robinson in its progeny does not impair any substantive right under the federal law. So the BorgWarner concept of defendant-specific dose being a substantial contributing factor in the causation of the disease, that's legal causation. That's whether or not a defendant is going to be held liable for their relative, I mean, there's a lot of dispute and debate about exactly what BorgWarner is going to mean as it percolates through the courts, but as I read it, whether we're going to impose liability on a defendant for a de minimis exposure relative to the universe. Well, in the Jones Act, he gets to recover for that. So that case doesn't apply, and likewise, Havner would not apply in the sense that they relate to legal sufficiency of causation evidence, not admissibility. In the Rule 702, the real difference between 702 and 90.004 is in the impairment evaluation. It doesn't have anything to do with how the doctor gets to the point. Now, the question was, do I have an opposition to filing the report required? Well, in report form, perhaps. Because under our rules, we don't have a reporting requirement. 702 doesn't say you have to say all this in a report. They can go take the doctor's deposition and figure out what he did.
Well, you could do it.
I could do it.
Trial judge could order that under 166A.
That is true. That is true. And I ordinarily wouldn't have a problem doing it, except it adds another layer of expense between the examination, the report, and then the deposition, because he has to be deposed anyway. I want to talk for a moment, and I did, somewhat, about the effect on the plaintiff's claims. You know, and this is really the crux of the issue, is what happens once he gets there. This court could find that the transfer provision is not preempted, it's merely procedural, and just send it back. Well, the moment that happens, I have to go file a motion basically asking for preemption. That these portions are preempted, because although, respectfully to my opposing counsel, they may have conceded here today that these four things are preempted, I'm fairly certain that if this court does not write on this issue, that we're going to be right back up here on a Bogle issue in a couple of years as to whether I have to meet the impairment criteria. At some point, the court is going to have to find preemption. And the 14th Court of Appeals logically said, well, it's preempted everywhere else. It's preempted in the case management order in the MDL proceeding. It's preempted in the remand provision. It's preempted everywhere. So logically, it's preempted on the way in. And I want to raise this one point. The Texas legislature, and rightly or wrongly, I have very intimate familiarity with Chapter 90. And what they did, they didn't intend for all silica cases and all asbestos cases to go to the MDL. As a matter of fact, there are hundreds of cases that were filed prior to September 1 of 2003 that never went to an MDL. So the reliability and consistency argument really doesn't apply here. Rule 13, prospectively, after House Bill 4, was about reliability and consistency and the steady judicial hand at the helm making uniform rulings in all these cases. But the old cases are simply treated differently. Those cases only go to the MDL if they're unimpaired.
Well, we shouldn't make it worse. I mean, there are some old cases, but they'll go away someday. Mm-hmm. And why continue to contribute to the reliability and consistency problem?
Well, again, it's not the transfer that's the problem. It's what happens once we get there. And that's what I think the 14th Court said. You know, these cases are just different. There's not a volume of Jones Act cases that are asbestos and silica cases out there. You know, we, in our brief, make the statement that, as far as we know, we're the only one that is a pre-9103 Jones Act, silica case that's been transferred to the MDL.
But
we can't know that.
But preemption will apply from here on out.
At some point, it has to.
And isn't it worthwhile? I mean, you would immediately upon arrival be able to move that our requirement to do this report showing impairment is preempted, but you would still have some pretrial proceedings to do, and the part of Rule 13.7 that says, well, we're going to remand it back when those pretrial proceedings are completed. Now, we're not going to include a requirement of showing impairment. What would be the harm in still coordinating? So, frankly, we don't have cases just like yours that are filed in the future that are tried and prepared one way in South Texas and a different way in East Texas.
Well, that is exactly what I offered to the defendant at the hearing over 2 years ago, was, and I said it to Judge Christopher, I do not care if I'm in the MDL. I just don't want to have to file the report because it's preempted. And they wouldn't agree to that then, and then the sand kind of shifted as we've been through the appellate proceedings. And this case has been to virtually every court you can go to in Texas, and the sand has shifted a little bit under their feet, and now we're at the point where, okay, we agree, the defendant, at least for now, concedes that the impairment criteria is preempted. Had it been conceded back then, we wouldn't be here. So there is no harm in and of itself. And I think, though, that the 14th Court of Appeals recognized that rather than do this on a case-by-case basis, I mean, my concern is I don't want to have another appeal once we go back to Judge Christopher and she says, okay, I said it once, I'm going to say it again, it's preempted. Now, you're going to stay here, but you don't have to do any of this. Well, that's going right back up. And I would just ask that if that's the path the court chooses, that the opinion make it clear that this is procedural, this is substantive, and once you're here, none of the rest of it's going to apply.
Any further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I was very pleased to hear Mr. Black's presentation. It seems that we have many areas of agreement. One area in which we must disagree, though, is that the positions have changed. The original hearing in this case is part of the record, and this court can read it. And the holdings The actual rulings in this case from the Silica MDL pretrial court and the 14th Court of Appeals are that not only must no report of any kind be filed, but that Chapter 90 is preempted in its entirety, in toto, period. As a starting point, that cannot be right. Section 90009 has to do with the way in which a trial is conducted. It has nothing to do with the report whatsoever. So that statement must be overbroad. Moving back even from that point, the question is, what does one do with these sections that appear to have no impact whatsoever? As is acknowledged, they fall within the realm of jurisprudence. And the distinction is, and the reason why they needed to be spelled out in the first place, was that courts weren't doing it. Judge Jack, in spelling this out, made a point of saying, I'm explaining all of this for the benefit of other courts that haven't had the time or her personal experience as a registered nurse to explain why these kinds of half reports, these papered over doctor's opinions, don't suffice. What the legislature has done here is valuable. It's not the same as Rule 702 because it spells out these requirements. But nonetheless, it falls within the realm of those procedural and evidentiary matters that do not impact the substantive federal maritime law.
I understand why you disagree with the CA opinion. Mm-hmm. Where do you disagree with opposing counsel as to his argument? What are your points? It sounds to me like y'all are largely in agreement on many issues.
I believe our area of disagreement is his statement that he should not have to file a report, which I am not clear where he would believe he doesn't have to file a report under the expert designation rules for deposition.
He filed a report, is my understanding.
He's filed a report. We do not agree that it meets the non-preempted requirements of Chapter 90, but no court has ever reached that question. As I understand his position here today, he believes that preemption means he doesn't have to file any report. He can go to the MDL, he can be subject to that, he can be remanded out, but that he doesn't have to file a report. Our area of disagreement is he does have to file a report. He does have to meet the additional requirements spelled out in Section 90
well,
to ensure that they're reliable.
It's the pretrial report. How would you be harmed if under 13.5 it was just removed as a tag-along case, if these cases in the future were just removed as tag-along cases? And then in the course of pretrial discovery, you get the name of a doctor who meets the qualifications, who meets the requirements of 90, who's going to be the expert and going to say, I've looked at him, he's got silicosis.
Because the legislature has deemed that that report should be filed at the beginning of the case, just as it does in medical malpractice cases. And it has declared, we want to just cut out a certain amount of discretion, frankly, in the trial courts, and declare we're not going to let doctors try to offer these opinions unless they can meet the requirements of medical science. Now, it may be that Judge Christopher and Judge Davidson would require these same things. What we get, though, what our benefit is the legislature declaring that it must be thus, because without it, we had a crisis that had to be stopped in this state.
Do you agree with Mr. Black that Ohio's version of Chapter 90 is like ours in Texas?
I am not aware of any aspect of their impairment requirements that are distinct. There are slight, modest differences in the way that they would define an impairment that are so modest I could not tell the court why they would matter. The key distinction is that Ohio has seized the reins and declared that impairment equals injury. And I would suggest that it is not contrary to the Ayers case out of the Supreme Court. The Ohio Supreme Court cites Ayers as the basis for its explanation of what FELA requires. This was not a blind statement. What they've declared is supported by the Restatement Third of Torts.
You'll agree that their version of Chapter 90 and ours are materially the same.
If there is a distinction relevant to this particular issue, I don't know what it is.
But the Bogle court said that none of their version was preempted, correct?
That's correct.
So you have conceded that certain portions of Chapter 90 are preempted.
That is correct, because before the Ohio Supreme Court's opinion, there was no case answering the precise question, what do you do with somebody who has no impairment but has a disease? The Ohio Supreme Court was the first and broke ground in that area.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.